Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in African Studies. My name is Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, one of the hosts of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Gregory Mann about his new book, From Empires to NGOs in the West African Sahel, The Road to Non-Governmentality, published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. Gregory Mann is an associate professor at the history department at Columbia University, and he specializes in the history of Francophone West Africa. Dr. Gregory Mann, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if we could start the interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an historian of Africa. I live in New York City. I live actually in a somewhat African neighborhood of New York City in Harlem. And I've been doing research and visiting Mali in particular for about 20 years now. And that's pretty much the story. I grew up in New Orleans. I grew up in a sort of polyglot and interesting kind of town. Spent most of my formative years in the South and got interested in African history partly because it seemed to me that I had reached a point in my training in history as an undergraduate in which I realized I knew absolutely nothing about Africa that had any substance at all. And that kind of lack of knowledge attracted me to the subject matter because I began to wonder why it was that Africa was so absent from the curriculum where I was at the time at the University of Georgia. And since I got taken under the wing by a very good historian there, David Schoenbrunn, who put me on the straight path to the study of Africa. So it was a series of good undergraduate mentors and advisors who encouraged me to pursue historical research, and eventually I ended up working in Mali under the supervision of Dr. John Hunwick, who was one of the great historians of Islamic Africa, and particularly the manuscript tradition. And although I don't work in Arabic and I don't work in that tradition, the training of working on pre-colonial Africa, work on Islamic Africa, thinking about Africa's place in the world, in different worlds beyond the colonial world, also in the Islamic episteme, was very formative for me in how I approach historical subjects in the African past.
So how did you come to this book? How did you come to write From Empires to NGOs?
I started thinking in the 1990s when I was working on my first book on Native Sons on West African veterans and France. I started to notice how in Mali, which was then in a period of democratic transition in the 1990s, there was a great deal of contest on the streets about political power and how it was wielded, particularly the presidency. But at the same time, there was an enormous expansion of NGO activity. And it seemed to me that all the young entrepreneurial people I met who had the kind of skill and the means, and even people who were not so young, who were in their 40s and 50s, were opening, starting NGOs. And that there was a great scramble for local contracts, for local NGOs to get contracts from external funders. And that this was having a real effect on government in the country of Mali, and particularly in even in rural areas where there was a simultaneous process of political decentralization, so that more political power and administrative capacity was being pushed out from the center in the capital to the rural areas, the smaller towns and cities, and even into the villages. And so it was just this kind of strange confluence of things where you saw these very active NGOs and what seemed to be a fairly inactive, in many ways seemed to be an inactive state or a kind of demoralized state. And you would find, I use this image in the book, but going down the road, and I traveled around a lot in Mali at that time, I had a little motorcycle and I would drive around, and you would pass these checkpoints where, you know, there'd be these gendarmes kind of sleeping on the side of the road, sort of representing state power in some way. And you would see these big, powerful white 4x4s that the NGOs prefer, you know, zooming up and down the highways. And the sort of contrast between state immobility and NGO mobility was quite striking. And it got me interested in how there were different forms of political power at work and what the history of that, those forms of political power was. And then over time, I began to realize that it was important to understand how Mali had its own very particular political history, and that it had had a strong and active state at some point, which is important. And it was never just a part of a kind of a France-Afrique kind of neo-colonial dispensation in which France was really pulling the strings. This doesn't really describe Mali very well at all. And so it was important to think about this period of ambition and state power in the 1960s in contrast with the rise of NGO power in the 1990s and more recently. And that I struggled in a thing about what would be a research project that would be able to get its arms around both this early period of at least the perception of state power and a set of ambitions and a sort of vision of sovereignty, which in some ways is very normative, but was very clear about what the African nation state could be. And the period of the more recent period, which is neoliberal, but not only neoliberal, in which the market predominates over the state in many ways, but in which the international NGOs have so much capacity within a place like Mali and across the Sahel more broadly. And so I started to think of a research project that would allow me both to think about the political history of the place and recognize that it has its own political history, which is very important, but also to get away from the kind of conceptual framework of African history in which it's usually written, in which independence is this key kind of turning point. And even in the ways in which we, you know, casually conceive of African history as kind of pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial, that's really inadequate to understand the kind of transitions at work in contemporary Africa. And so I wanted to do a kind of project that had some ability to look into the more distant past, and as you know, into the 19th century in any case, but also was very aware of this sort of contemporary political scenario as being the product of a great deal of political work and a series of initiatives and projects, you know, some of which failed and some of which succeeded. But basically to get away from the kind of idea that colonial history was really determining everything that was happening in the post-colony, which doesn't make any sense, or is sort of over-argued, over-determined. I mean, it's a sort of, it doesn't hold up very well. And to think about African history in its own sort of temporalities with its own kind of, you know, moyen-dire kind of characteristics and things that happen that extend across generations, across decades, and that continue to have a kind of force behind them or a certain momentum. I also wanted to, and I don't want to go on too long about this, but just conceptually, to think about the periodization differently was important for me in the book. And one thing that really mattered to me a great deal was to think about causality differently. And what the book doesn't try to do is to make an overdetermined argument or even a determined argument, right? The book makes an argument about contingency and the phenomenon of non-governmentality, or the way in which sort of governmental rationality is practiced within Sahelian states, not by the states themselves, but by the confluence of international NGOs, their own donors and agendas, and local NGOs, which work in a more sort of neoliberal logic of the market, that the form of non-governmentality that emerged in the Sahelian states is not a product of anyone's design. There's no great scheme behind it. There's no great logic behind it. There's no single cause that produces this phenomenon, that it has multiple origins. And in fact, the people who built up the great capacity of the state, of the ambitious state of the early 1960s, would have been horrified to see this outcome as not their intended outcome. And what I felt somewhat liberated by, even in writing the book, was recognizing that the causality is not at all clear, and then it needn't be, and that the burden of historical argument needn't be to determine really the causality. And so that was sort of important to me in making the argument in the book that stretches from this period of sort of strong state control and ambition to a period where those things are much more diffuse and it's much more complex. It's a much sort of slippery scenario, but that I didn't have to draw very clear lines.
I mean, I also felt that to a large degree, you were facing a very interesting challenge, which is probably shared by many historians who try to write about ideas, you know, and it's basically how to appreciate both the genesis and the evolution of those ideas. And in some ways, like you mentioned, the often unintended consequences of those ideas and how they are thought in one way. There's a theory behind what the what government is or what government should be. And then once they start to get implemented, they just kind of take a life of their own. And it's particularly, I think, difficult for historians to sort of find the right, like you say, the right kind of framework to present those stories. And I felt like the structure and the strategy in your book were very consciously thought to find that framework, you know, how to tell this story without making it, like you say, a story that has a clear beginning, middle, and end. So can you tell us a little bit more about how sort of you came to structure the book? It's a very interesting, and you mentioned in your introduction, it's not meant to be comprehensive, it's not meant to be chronological, but it is quite a feat that you do end up with a sense of a history, that you have told us a history. So can you tell us more about it? Was it a matter of sources, the things that you had available to you? How did you choose these particular topics to tell this story?
Well, that's an interesting question that makes me reflect on the sort of accident by which the book itself comes into being. And so my methodology, which is too big a word for is kind of an ad hoc practice, right, is that most of the chapters of the book effectively emerge from finding one archival load or one kind of chunk of a story or a phenomena or an argument and kind of working out from that. So there's a chapter on the period in which there was a set of political prisoners from the socialist anti-colonial government of the USRDA, the USRDA, who were sent to these Saharan prisons, and that they became the objects of a human rights campaign directed at Mali in the 1970s. And that grew partly from debates within Mali about the history of these prisoners and what had happened to them and who was responsible for that and should there be a kind of accounting for that. And there was a series of kind of tell-all memoirs that were being published in the late 90s, early 2000s. Around these questions. And so it was a real debate within Mali that kind of brought me partly to that. But also recognizing, oh, this matches up with these human rights campaigns from the outside. And I used Amnesty in particular because those are the archives that I had available, and they were a particularly obviously powerful player on the scene. So there's a sense in which, you know, you recognize a question, you recognize something that seems important, that matters to people. That's a question that mattered to people in Mali in particular. And then think about, well, how does it play on the outside, and where can I find the interface between these forces that are at work around the globe? I mean, Amnesty is an international organization with a big reach, which is only one representation of a whole human rights movement that comes to flourishing, especially in the 1970s. How does it match up with this particular history of Mali, or that, and how does that reflect something broader across the Sahel, perhaps? So it's part of the accident of where there's a set of archives around that. And partly strategic. I mean, there's a chapter that is about how it is that the French state in the late 1950s, early 1960s, was attempting to claim Muslim pilgrims in the Sudan. Why was it that France was eagerly trying to claim them as its own citizens or former citizens or nationals? And how it was that the Sahelian states themselves were thinking about their pilgrims as citizens, which is a different way to conceptualize a centuries-old phenomenon of people making the pilgrimage overland across the Sahel from Senegal, Mali, etc., to the Hejaz, obviously, but often stopping in Sudan either on the way there or on the way back, and setting up these very important West African communities in Sudan, which suddenly become the object of some kind of contest at the period of independence of first of Sudan and then of the different Sahelian states. That particular chapter grew partly out of finding out that in a systematic way, I tried to read the French embassy reports across the Sahel for the 1960s. Because if you go to where the diplomatic archives are, the embassy reports are in Nantes in France. You can start in Dakar in the west, and you can read all the way to Asmara in the east. And so I read across the Sahel for that decade. What were the questions that were being recognized by these in these consular reports? Now, there's a selection effect there because it's the French consular reports. They're interested in consular questions, which are often about nationality, citizenship, membership, migration, etc. And, you know, I had thought a lot about the Hajj routes before, and I'd written a little bit about that before. And it jumped out. There was this real debate about who were these pilgrims? Who were they? Not in the sense of, well, obviously they're Muslims, they're pilgrims, they're coming from one part of Africa and going to the Hijaz. But also, who, to whom did they belong? To which nation state did they belong? Who could claim them? And why did that matter suddenly in some strange way? And I really wanted that chapter in the book to offer a very different axis for thinking about Sahelian history over the longer time periods. But in contrast to the sort of south-north migration from especially Senegal, Mali, Mauritania, to France, which is a very well-studied phenomenon. And there's a second chapter that is about precisely that phenomenon of migration to France and how it was that West Africans established themselves in France and how their political statuses changed greatly over time and created a kind of language of conceptual vocabulary for thinking about their place in this emerging nation state of kind of effectively hexagonal France, right? That France, you know, truncated of its empire, shorn of its empire, becoming a different kind of nation state within a European context, was also receiving significant amount of migration from the former empire. And then it was clear that in that instance, that again, it was a phenomenon that's been well studied, rarely from the African point of view, much more often from the French point of view, but that even from the French archives and the Malian archives and the Senegalese archives, it becomes clear that the migrants who were going to France in the 1960s are not being, you know, refused by France, quite to the contrary. And then, in fact, it's places like Mali and Guinea with their socialist politics that are quite eager and determined, in fact, to claim that migrant labor as their own and to even to forbid people from migrating to France to work. But the two chapters that I meant to be as kind of two different axes, two different ways of thinking about this phenomenon of migration, which is really characteristic of the Sahel, especially since the 1970s, but always, it's always been a place of great movement and mobility. The geography lends itself to that, as do the climatic conditions and so forth. And to think these are both long-durée questions, as in the case of the pilgrimage, but also questions that emerge in complex moments like that of decolonization. And one final thing that I would say about sort of the structure of the book. So this is two chapters about the politics, the building up of a state or states across the Sahel, and the building up of the idea of a kind of a social logic in the Sahel. Two chapters about migration I've just discussed to Sudan and to France. And then two chapters, one about the famine of the 1970s and the efforts around its relief. And the last one about the human rights campaigns of the 1970s. But running through these is a kind of a weak narrative structure, a deliberately weak narrative structure, which is maybe annoying for some readers, but hopefully not too annoying, of using the figure of Madira Keita as a character who reappears in almost every one of these chapters. And Madira Keita is an interesting and kind of complex figure who I try to use as a vehicle to both offer a kind of a string that helps to tie the different chapters together, but also a kind of a person who consistently animates the chapters in different ways. And that's not entirely successful insofar as my own vision of him is not super well-rounded. There's a great amount on the public sphere. His private sort of characteristics, you know, it's not a biography anyway, but sort of his private kind of characteristics, his full family dynamics, his full family history. I was a bit ginger about entering too deeply into that, partly out of respect for his family and partly out of just the weaknesses of my own research. But he reappears in every one of these chapters. He's a powerful minister in the Malian government. He's a key figure in the formation of the anti-colonial and multi-territorial political party, the RDA or the RDA. He helps to found that in Bamako and in Guinea. He's one of the key persons, key people in Guinea's powerful anti-colonial movement. He's involved with the research agenda of Georges Malinger, who's a very influential French sociologist of the post-war period. And he is a really determinative figure in the way that Mali's politics emerges in the 1960s, which is crucial to the book insofar as the argument has to be made that Mali is not part of this France-Afrique scenario from the get-go, and that it has its own political forces and it has its own history. And there is a degree of self-determination there, which is easily sort of set aside by histories and other studies of West African politics or African politics that kind of assume that everything is neocolonial, that everything's always already arranged, which in this period in the 60s is very much not the case. So I try to use Keita as a kind of narrative vehicle in some way, partly because coincidentally he just reappears over and over again. Except for the chapter on the human rights campaigns in which he's the subject. He becomes one of these political prisoners that Amnesty is trying to free. He's the subject of a human rights campaign. But more appropriately, actually, he's the object of a human rights campaign insofar as he's not himself. He's a prisoner. He's not directly engaged in it. But he is the object of a number of kind of letters and letter writing campaigns and interventions from beyond Mali to get the national government to liberate him. So I use him as this kind of a character. And the whole then of the book is composed around three pairs of chapters, each looking at a different moment, a different kind of set of forces. But what I hope is a way that's provocative and interesting, because actually as you move from one chapter to another, you basically leap into a whole other context. I mean, you leap from, you know, Eastern Sudan into, you know, Paris and its suburbs. And then you sort of leap from there back to the Sahel in the time of famine, and then you leap from there to these salt mines in the Sahara. So that in some sense, you know, by the time you're bored with one chapter, hopefully the next chapter is opening up something entirely different that propels the book forward in some sense. That was a bit my sort of narrative strategy, to the extent that the book has a narrative strategy.
I also got the sense that in choosing choosing the Sahel as sort of like the regional focus of the book, you know, you were talking about the different sort of cleavages or the different ways in which African history is narrated, and particularly in this period, I've always found it very interesting how we talk about sort of the history of African nationalism, but rarely is that history really focused in nation states. You know, it's kind of like African nationalism is like this big thing, and we apply it to nation states. But even if we were to apply it to nation states, it wouldn't necessarily make all that much sense. And I get the feeling that by choosing the Sahel as like a place that is not quite fixed, but it's kind of emerging in and of itself as a region throughout this period. You were able very much to portray that fluidity and that sort of political and social fluidity that sort of characterizes this area. And like you said, by that very measure, tie it to what we would say the pre-colonial period and the colonial period, and see how that doesn't stop. It never becomes, even after we see the emergence of specific nation states, that fluidity is not fixed in time.
Well, there's this kind of regional identity in the Sahel, and there is something that is identifiable as existing over a long period of time. There's a particular geography, and the conditions that it imposes and the way that people have adapted those over time. So to be at the limit of kind of rain-fed agriculture, to be just south of the Sahara, to be sort of constantly in contact with, you know, the Saharan world, with, by extension, then with the Mediterranean, with the Islamic world, but also with the societies, you know, to the south and to the west, creates a kind of, and also the point of having this, both this imperial history over time, the great African empires with which we're all familiar, you know, Ghana, Mali, Songhai, but more recently, you know, the Masina, the different sort of Islamic states of El Hajj Martal, etc., creates a kind of shared identity of the Sahel, which is always fluid. It's kind of a weak, it's not a binding identity in some sense. It's an area characterized by pastoralism, by different efforts at state building, by migration and mobility. And that it's interesting to me the way in which this kind of geographic designator, which is always a fairly weak one, it's always imprecise, just the way the desert moves back and forth and the seasons change and whatnot. It becomes much more structurally rigid in some sense as an identity with the creation of the SILS, or the Committee for the Struggle Against the Drought in the Sahara and Sahel, in the 1970s, and becomes this kind of regional identifier. And it's really at that point in the 70s people started talking about Sahel as this kind of coherent and really concrete identity of several different member states, some of which actually aren't technically Sahelian. I wanted to suggest that looking at that region, which has its own historicity, allows one to sort of bear in mind there are these sort of longer durée characteristics of African history, and that the challenge really is to sort of conjugate or combine all the different sort of temporalities at work, and the different kind of external and internal identities that are also at work. But to think about, well, look, there are things that have been going on for decades, for generations, maybe for centuries, or phenomena that have been present. They've changed, they're dynamic, they shift over time. But, you know, the Sahelian states now have been part of the societies that compose them, and part of the Muslim world for centuries, varying degrees of capture or purchase or traction. The colonial period was short, very short in many places, and could be very violent, but was not really determinative in the way that it's often portrayed to be, too easily portrayed to be. And that there's now 50 years of post-colonial history, which are 50 very poorly understood years of what happened after independence. And the amount of real historical work, by which I mean rigorous, you know, multi-source work on the post-colonial political history of Sahelian states and many other African states, it's just incredibly weak. It's really incredibly weak. There's now lots of great stuff being done, but when you read that, you understand how shallow the foundation actually is, that people are doing foundational work in post-colonial history from which they then can build maybe, you know, really wonderful excursions into the political history and into the history of the present. But they have to do a lot of foundational work. And my intention in the book, in some ways, the whole sort of first part of the book, which I think is, you know, I'm happy with that part of the book, but it does this kind of foundational work that I sometimes think, gee, if I were writing about it, even a different part of Africa, but certainly a different part of the world, like there would be a library that does this foundational work, you know, that sort of lays down what exactly was going on. And it clears out some of the thicket of the kind of the mythologies, the nationalist mythologies that also the oral history also easily produces, to sort of really understand, well, what are the decisions that people are making, and why are they making those decisions, and in what context, and what are the effects, anticipated and unanticipated, of the decisions that people make. So where were we? You know, how do we get here? But without only thinking backwards, but also thinking forwards from those really germinal moments of the late 1950s, early 1960s, when important decisions were made that did have ongoing effects, but that the secondary literature captures the dynamics, you know, fairly poorly. It's an interesting thing. If you look back at some of the best work, what's the best work on, you know, take a given African nation state. I don't claim to know the whole library, right? But often the best work is the work of political scientists in the 1960s. I mean, if I want to think about Cote d'Ivoire, if I want to think about Mali, I want to look at Aristide Zolberg, which is, you know, 1966. And that is a period in which political scientists did great work. And there's a long period in which it's not recent enough to be of interest to political scientists, not far enough away to be of interest to historians. So not that much is produced that is very rigorously researched. And there was a recent kind of return to think about, oh, well, we need to be able to think about African politics and African nation states and African political phenomenon as historical phenomenon. And there's a great deal of foundational work to be done in order to pursue that.
I think that also part of that lacking in the foundational work that you mentioned is it's probably a function, if not, it's a function of a number of things. But one of the things that I think is a function of is that the very sort of shallow, intellectual history that we have of this period, like you said, that we have this truncated understanding of how ideas about the state government or, you know, most intellectual production, sort of something emerges after independence, something was going on during colonialism, and to some extent, even less we understand what was happening before. And one of the things that I very much enjoyed in particularly in your examination of Madeira Keita, is particularly how he's not constrained by thinking of himself as like what part of my thinking is colonial or anti-colonial or African or neo-colonial or whatever. You know, he's an intellectual. He's thinking, and he's also an activist, and he doesn't seem to be particularly trying to position himself in one way or another. And the way in which you kind of trace his intellectual evolution, like you said, is not unique. You know, I mean, at least from my own work on sort of 19th century writers in Ghana, it resonated quite a bit. The way in which these writers reflected about the role and the nature of state and government, and how much of that the historiography tends to sort of bypass, ignore, or like interpret as either nationalist or, and if they cannot figure out how to present it as nationalist, they just don't present it at all. So in that respect, I felt that your book, again, you know, presents a very complex understanding of a new way of thinking about intellectual history in Africa, both chronologically and thematically, and just in the way in which it constructs the object of study, in this case, the idea of government. You know, how do these intellectuals or intellectuals like Madeira Keita thought about government, how they were translated into effective policies, and you know, how they responded or not to very concrete challenges on the ground. I'm not incredibly familiar with the way in which intellectual history of French intellectuals has been written in French colonial Africa. So do you feel that that's part of the foundational work that you had to do, just kind of figure out how Madeira Keita fit in a larger intellectual history?
Yes, I mean, that's a difficult thing to do, of course, and I find that really pushing. I have a great deal of respect for my colleagues who are actually intellectual historians, because I find that work very hard to do, because I always think it's at the limits of interpretation to know how and why people think and argue the way they do. And to recognize, for example, the connections between what one reads or what one hears, the arguments to which one is exposed or even, you know, with which one engages, and the actual kind of decisions and particularly the political decisions and the kind of tactics that emerge from that. And what's confounding about someone like Madeira Keita is, above all, he's a tactician. I mean, he's a kind of political street fighter. He is someone who has a very clear vision of what he wants to do and works with great, I mean, I do admire the person in particular ways that he did have a great deal of sort of, seems to be kind of disciplined about what he wanted to achieve. I sort of recognize that characteristic is, without trying to be captured by that. But that, you know, the connection between the ideas to which one is exposed or the people engaged with and the tactical choices made politically about how to achieve what one wants to achieve, that's very hard to establish and sustain. Someone like Keita and his closest kind of peers and colleagues, where I think in many ways, in ways that are often forgotten or maybe just unknown, I mean, really the product of this communist training in the 1940s, from which they took the idea of what the structure and the mechanics of the party ought to be, which made them very good at building kind of political parties on a certain blueprint. They didn't really take entirely, they took some of the analytical vocabulary without necessarily taking the analysis. And so they weren't sort of dyed in the wool communist, although someone like Keita is a little closer to that than some of the others were in different places. But they had an idea of what the party was supposed to do and how it was supposed to work. And that was quite influential for them. So they knew what a party was. They knew what the state was because they were fighting against it, but also working within it. And it's one of the sort of characteristics of the anti-colonial movements across the continent, but I think it's even more acute in Francophone Africa that, you know, all the sort of leading cadres of the political parties, the anti-colonial parties, were at the same time civil servants. They worked within the lower ranks of the administration, and they witnessed how it was the administration functioned, and they were very much trained in that regard. But what changed quite dramatically, and I think it's a shift that happens over, I say it's dramatic, but also happens over many years, with particular events like the Sahelian famine of 1973-74 being particularly important within it. But what changes over time is not so much the idea of what the state is and should do, but the idea of what government is, what it means to govern, and what exactly is being governed. And I think that that's really the question that most separates the sort of political scenario that one can recognize, you know, over the last 20 years or so in contemporary Africa from what would have prevailed in the decades previous to that. It's not so much about the state. It's about what we think that government is and is meant to do. And is government meant to assure the conditions of life? Is government meant to sort of intervene medically, biomedically? What are the sort of social obligations that the state is meant to provide, and which partly determine its success or its failure. And one of the key issues that I look at in the book around this question is speaks to the question of sovereignty as well, is the human rights debates, and to what extent is it down to a national government to govern the conditions of life, to control the conditions of life of its citizens, the most extreme, you know, the outlier example being the political prisoners. You know, can they be abused in any way that the state sees fit, or their kind of international norms and practices that, to which they will be sort of brought, by which they will be brought to account or brought to book eventually. And it's this shifting idea of what is government and the capacity of government to provide. And then, of course, the failure of the states to actually be able to govern in that much broader sense of what governing means by the 1970s and certainly by the 1980s, it's the failure of states to offer that that is the ongoing kind of, you know, macro theme of African politics over the last several decades. You know, it's the state can't actually govern on its own because now what it means to govern is so expansive, but also because in the West African scenario, the more radical or the more sharply anti-colonial of the party states worked against quite deliberately the local institutions of government or instances of government, which were the chiefs. And the breaking apart of the chieftaincy, while it might have been progressive in some sense, and certainly moved towards the sort of democratization and the sort of realization of the Republican ideal of equality amongst the citizens, at the same time stripped these ambitious nation states like Guinea and Mali, also to some extent Niger, which has a more complicated history in this regard, it stripped them of the capacity to actually administer on the ground, because they didn't. It took out the kind of middle layer of the administration. When the chiefs were dismissed, you had only the civil service left, and the civil service was not so numerous, not so well trained, not present evenly across the country. And so there's an increasingly great mandate of what it means to govern. You have to do many more things, and a diminished capacity of the state to actually provide those things. And in some ways, it's a very simple administrative problem, but it opens up this key space into which the NGOs emerge. And as the conditions of life degrade in the context of the drought and the ensuing famine, the NGOs emerge. And over time, states become very reliant on NGOs to actually take up some of the charge of governance is to be taken up by the NGOs. And the usual way of thinking of this is, of course, that means that the states are now weaker. But one of the cautions that I try to express in the book, and then I'm not alone in this regard, is to recognize that, in fact, the more that international NGOs absorb the charge of government in Africa, and particularly in the Sahel, the more it liberates, in some sense, states to engage in other pursuits. So let's leave the NGOs to do the sort of the biopower model of governing. Let's invest in state security, right? Let's invest in maintaining ourselves in power, or let's invest in maintaining this sort of administrative structure, or we can pursue other initiatives and other agenda without necessarily being bogged down or captured by this very expansive notion of government that has come to prevail.
This question of what is government and or what is not, or what it should be, etc., is obviously neither unique nor new to African post-independent states. I found it very provoking in the sense that it seems like it would be, like you said, something that we take for granted, and how in the context of these emerging states, sort of it becomes relevant again. And I wonder whether you think that it should become relevant even outside of that context. What do you think that we can learn from the history of non-governmentality in the Sahel more broadly, both in terms of the study of the politics and political ideas in and about Africa, and just in terms of political thought more widely?
That's such a compelling question, because I struggle with this, right? On one hand, as a historian, one wants to underscore the particularities, the unique trajectories, the long-durée characteristics of a given object of study, take the Sahel, in the present case, right? On the other hand, analytically, one doesn't want to get captured by that particularity to say that, look, what happens in the Sahel is unique to the Sahel, could only happen here. It's limited to Africa, or it's limited to just this part of Africa. So these two things, in some sense, in tension with each other. My sense is, and I I'm an historian of West Africa. This is the only place that I know, right? But my sense is, the more I worked on this project, that actually what was going on in the Sahel in the last several decades is merely an extreme example of a sort of a broader shift that is happening elsewhere, elsewhere across the African continent, and then in other parts of the world as well. But in other parts of the world, often the state is either is more powerful or secure, or is less subject to the sort of the leverage of the international donors or the international financial institutions. Donor is a bit of a charged word, but that capacity of the ability of the neoliberal ideology expressed through the international financial institutions in the Sahelian states in the particular to provoke the shedding of industries, the shedding of state industries, the shedding of state obligations, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, was extreme. And that what was left was a very stripped down kind of state, which could not meet the obligations that and the aspirations that the founding sort of generation had set in some way, and maybe no longer really aspired to do that. But that sort of the starkness of the Sahelian example does not mean the Sahelian example is unique. That the rise of this kind of non-governmentality, I argue in the book, it precedes the sort of neoliberal moment, but of course it's exacerbated by the effects of the neoliberal ideology. In other words, its real origins lay partly, and this is the law of sort of unintended consequences, its real origins in the Sahel lay in the ambitious socialist projects of the 1960s. But in fact, the some of those gestures, some of those moves, some of those anti-colonial policies I mentioned before, the abolition of the chieftaincy, for example, opened up this gap between state and government into which the NGOs could move. Their presence is not entirely a product of the neoliberal moment. It precedes the neoliberal moment, but the neoliberal moment of the expansion of the market logic, the shrinking of the state and its capacities, exacerbates the problem of or the phenomenon of non-governmentality. And in that regard, I think opens up this very unclear scenario in which conceivably, and sort of for the states, for the sake of argument, one could say, well, perhaps it is that people living in Sahelian states can call on services that are provided, funded, organized, orchestrated from abroad, or in some kind of collaboration of local organizations and instances, civic or otherwise, with outside actors of different kinds. So perhaps governing in that large sort of biopower sense of governing is more effective in under the phenomenon or the umbrella of non-governmentality. But on the other hand, it does raise a question, which is that of participation, in that one of the things that was striking to me over the last 20 years in Mali is the degree to which the political questions on the ground, sometimes they're very local and they're very particular, and you don't actually fully understand what's at stake, which I think many people recognize this phenomenon. What's really at stake in this argument between these two parties or between these two characters? But sometimes the things that become real flashpoints are initiatives from abroad that are being brought into places like Mali or Niger or Burkina, where they don't translate in very well or translate into something that is very different than what people might want. More clearly, if I can say that a little more clearly, you could see that, for instance, international feminist organizations might have a particular vision of what they would like to see as local policy around family law, for example. And given the leverage they might have in a place like Mali or a place like Niger, they might be able to impose part of that vision on the sort of the institutional politics, the presidency down. But the street might not accept that vision. And might push back, which is what happened notably in Mali 2009, 2011. But one thing that stands out to me in that regard is not to say that feminist organizations are right and the street is wrong or vice versa, because it's not really my role analyzing the scenario here, right? But would be to say, isn't that interesting? This happens over and over again. And Aminata Draman Traore wrote a great deal about this. And I don't subscribe to all of the ideas of Aminata Traore, but one of the things that she pointed out, I think quite astutely, in the early 2000s was effectively, and I'm not really paraphrasing here, but this is a lesson that I draw from what she says, that effectively a lot of the political questions, especially some of the most burning and some of the most intimate political questions at work in the Sahel are actually pushed from the outside, and that the issue is not even so much that the people living in those states, the citizens of those states, don't get to determine what the answers to those questions are. It's that they don't get to determine what the questions themselves are. So is the burning social issue of a given society, is it the right to divorce, or is it marriage of people who are very young, or is it excision, or is it rights of inheritance? So, you know, these are a whole set of issues that one can cast under the broad kind of net of, you know, being around family law and human rights. But tactically on the ground, Malian feminists would have chosen a different set of issues to pursue than international feminists chose to pursue. And this is actually sort of the missing chapter of the book, if I were going to write volume two or something like that, would be precisely about feminist politics. There's two places that I don't touch in the book, the two phenomena I don't really touch in the book. And one is feminist politics, where I think you can really see non-governmentality at work and unanticipated consequences at work around feminist politics. And the second would be sort of the biomedical, which I just feel like I don't really have the expertise or the capacity to really address, but like where NGO activity is starkest and maybe in some ways most, you know, kind of productive, right, is around the way that the national systems of health and international capacities and imperatives sort of intersect, right? And I didn't broach those in the book because for various reasons, mostly because at some point I wanted to finish the book and I thought it could be endless, but that I saw these are the two places around health provision, healthcare provision, and around feminist politics and the way that it plays out. And I thought there were other people who were better positioned to address those two things. I thought those were beyond my capacity, beyond my knowledge, beyond my skill set, particularly in the biomedical sense. But I thought they were really the key sort of tests that maybe puts it too stark in too positivist a way, but these two kind of key phenomena that would help understand how non-governmentality works. And I just didn't really dare to attack them.
Well, Greg, I think I've taken a lot of your time now. Can you just tell us a little bit what you're currently working on?
Well, I worked for a while. The Mali crisis of 2012 and 13 happened. You know, the coup, the sort of foreign intervention, the war in the north is ongoing. I was involved in writing and thinking about that for some period of time, and then decided that okay, this is I want to now do something else. And so now I'm working on the exile of Samori Touré to Gabon. From 1898 to 1900. So it's a very different time period and actually a very different set of questions. So I'm sort of nibbling away at this brief moment in Samori's life when he was in exile and then he died in 1900 in exile, and trying to think about this sort of set of events that brings him to Gabon from Guinea and Mali and what that particular scenario might reveal about the broader question of the sort of emergent Franco-African world at that time.
That sounds exciting. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. Take care.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.